In the 1950s, British sports car manufacturers realised there were a lot of ex-GIs in America who wanted a bit of British sports car action that they'd seen during the war. This surge in interest made other Americans take a look at what Britain had to offer. MG had the MGA and the new MG Midget, and if you wanted to go upmarket, Jaguar were happy to sell you something fast and fun. Triumph had the TR cars, but thought they'd also expand their range. This is episode 5 of the Big Car Podcast, and today we'll be looking at the Triumph Spitfire, Triumph's 1960s and 70s fun sports car. So, on with the show. The Spitfire is a beautiful automobile, a thing of wonder penned by an Italian genius. But it almost never happened. If not for a chance find in a dusty corner of a factory, it would have remained merely a could have been. But Triumph produced a car that still inspires new creations today and has a strong and loyal fan base around the world, nearly 60 years after it burst on the scene. Here's the Triumph Spitfire story. Our story starts with the Austin Healey Sprite, launched in 1958. This was a cheap, fun two-seater that the everyday man could afford, and the public loved it. The Standard Motor Company, that owned the Triumph name, already produced a sports car. They had made the TR2 and TR3 since 1953, but it competed with more premium sports cars like MG's MGA. What they needed was something more price competitive at the low end, and Triumph felt that they could produce something superior to the Sprite. Standard already made the Triumph Herald, which featured a chassis with a bolt-on body. To save development money, they believed they could use the Herald chassis as a starting point, cut it down to size, and put on a sleek new shell. So in 1960, the Triumph boffins got out their angle grinders and got to work, under the project that was codenamed BOM. The design fell to Giovanni Michelotti, one of the most prolific sports car designers of the 20th century. He'd designed iconic Ferraris, Maseratis, Lancias, plus, surprisingly, the Leyland National Bus. He'd already designed the Herald for Triumph and was brought in to work his sports car magic for the BOM project. He created a beautifully balanced design that was to be a cut above the Sprite competition, having a bigger, faster engine and more interior space. However, Triumph's owners were in dire financial shape and were forced to sell to Leyland Motors in late 1960. The BOM project was forgotten as Triumph and Leyland focused on merging operations. In fact, the Spitfire would have been lost to time if it hadn't been for an enterprising Leyland manager who, while poking around in the Triumph factory, decided to look under a dust sheet and found the BOM prototype. Leyland loved the idea and started the project up again in July 1961. It was brought to market in an amazingly short time, launching in October 1962, just 15 months after Leyland had found that dusty prototype. It helped the chassis was already being used on the Triumph Herald, but it's still surprising that it was completed so quickly. A little too quickly, maybe, as owners discovered that when pushed hard, the rear end would have unpredictable responses that could make the car dangerous. Drivers found aftermarket solutions to fix this during the 60s, but it would take 8 years until it was fixed on production models. The car was launched as the Spitfire 4, a nod to the iconic plane from the Second World War and a reference to its inline four-cylinder engine. The exact reason why Triumph got to use the Spitfire name is unclear. At that time, the name was owned by Vickers, makers of the Vickers Valiant and other aircraft, and there's no record of Triumph licensing the brand. One theory goes that Triumph made Spitfire parts in their Coventry factory during the war, so Vickers turned a blind eye, but there isn't any evidence to back this up. The engine used was the 1.1-litre straight out of the Triumph Herald, and was accessed through a glorious one-piece bonnet that opened with side catches. The car came with fancy wind-up windows, something the Sprite was lacking, rubber floor mats, a big plastic steering wheel, as power steering wasn't yet common, locking doors, and a soft top that took a degree in tent assembly to master. Optional extras included a hard top, wire wheels, overdrive, and interestingly, a heater. It was more expensive than the Austin Healey Sprite, but customers were willing to pay a little extra, and soon the Spitfire was the top seller. And it certainly looked the part, a pure racing machine. But it's interesting to compare the performance figures from such a small engine vehicle to modern day cars. Think of the most underperforming Econobox you can buy today. That car can go faster from 0 to 60 than the first Spitfire, which took over 16 seconds. But the Spitfire was about enjoying the open road, and customers loved it. BMC, makers of the Austin Healey Sprite, continued to compete with newer versions, but they were always a little more underpowered. They also produced the MG Midget, but this was merely a rebadged Sprite, trading off the MG name. In 1964, they came up with the improved Sprite with door handles, locks, plus wind-down windows, but it was still a smaller car and had less power at 59 brake horsepower. Triumph reacted in 1965 with the Spitfire Mark II, but it was only a small upgrade. It had more power, a whole 67 brake horsepower up from 63, the US version had uprated suspension, and the interior was a little more comfortable, with carpets on the floor for the first time. Meanwhile, in the USA, sales were gaining apace. Triumph encouraged both Spitfire and their TR models to be entered into motor racing events and heavily advertised any wins. The old adage of win on Sunday, sell on Monday rang true, as the public came to see Triumphs as thoroughbred road-going sports cars. The Mark III Spitfire, introduced in 1967, included more major upgrades. The front bumper was raised to comply with US safety regulations, which gave it a dog with bone in its teeth look. The car received a larger 1.3-litre engine, which made it quicker and gave it a higher top speed, although 1969 US emissions laws robbed the engine of some of that sportiness. The do-it-yourself tent-like soft top was updated to a more practical fold-down model. The dashboard received a stylish wood veneer finish. In 1968, the 100,000th Spitfire rolled off the production line to much celebration. Over 75% of them had been exported, with 45% alone going to the USA. This really was turning into a British export success story. Triumph was always in hard competition with BMC and their Sprite and MG Midget, but in 1968 all three marks were joined under the same company, British Leyland. The competition between these cars wouldn't be quite as fierce from now on. 1970 brought the biggest changes yet in the form of the Spitfire Mark IV. Michelotti was brought in to do an almost complete reskin of the car, giving the rear a similar appearance to the Triumph Stag and 2000. It had flared wheel arches, the front was cleaned up with simpler chrome bumpers and black plastic underriders. Enthusiast drivers were happy that the rear end stability problems were finally solved. The dashboard got a big change. Previous Spitfires had the dashboard in the centre of the car, which made it simpler to make left or right hand drive models. But the Mark IV put the dashboard behind the steering wheel, something that had been added to the US 1969 Mark IIIs. And the heater was now finally standard equipment. But problems were just starting with parent British Leyland. As the 70s rolled on, money got tight, which robbed the Spitfire of major updates. However, for now, sales continued to be strong, and it seemed to be easy for British Leyland to keep raking in the export cash from their range of pocket sports cars. In 1966, Triumph had introduced the Michelotti-styled GT6, a coupe version of the Spitfire with a larger 2-litre 6-cylinder engine. The project had started out trying to make a coupe version with a Spitfire 4-cylinder engine, but the weight of the roof made the car too slow, so a larger engine was used. It unfortunately also inherited the Spitfire's rear-end stability issues. The Mark II GT6 was launched in 1969, with Spitfire Mark III styling cues. The Mark III arrived the following year in 1970, taking interior and styling changes from the Spitfire Mark IV. The GT6 never sold in the numbers British Leyland had hoped, and was discontinued in 1973. There was a constant complaint from US salespeople that the British management only designed cars for the UK market. They didn't understand the features needed by drivers in other countries. For example, North American temperatures were more extreme and cars did more sustained highway cruising. This affected the Spitfire less than other models, but it was something that lost sales along the way. In 1974, the Spitfire was renamed the Spitfire 1500, with the bigger 1500cc engine producing a faster car than before. But in the US, further emission requirements meant the new car was actually slower than the Mark II, Mark III and Mark IV. US front impact laws meant large black overriders on the front and rear bumpers, which made the car look ugly. However, handling was further improved, making it a really fun driver's car. British Leyland decided not to invest further in the Spitfire. It was probably down to the general lack of finances after being bailed out by the government in 1975, but certainly impending US legislation making open tops harder to sell didn't help. Furthermore, Japanese imports like the Datsun 240Z were continuing to eat into the British sports car market share, and competing with them would have required a big injection of cash. By the late 1970s, British Leyland were looking to close the Canley factory where the Spitfire was produced. It had built the Triumph Saloons and TR models, but those models had ceased or been moved to other factories. With the US exchange rate making the Spitfire an expensive car in its largest market, the decision was made to end production in 1980. An Inca Yellow Spitfire 1500 was the last to roll off the production line. Over 300,000 Spitfires were made over 18 years. Certainly a great success for any vehicle. For many years, there was an old 1970s Spitfire parked on a driveway near me, slowly rusting. It's since been removed to heaven knows where, but it's where I got some of the photos for the video version of this story. As you can tell from the whole Spitfire tale, safety standards were very different back in the 1960s. The Spitfire had rear instability for almost 10 years before Triumph got around to fixing it, and this was on a car that people bought to drive hard. In the 1990s, there were only a few reports of high-speed instability on the Audi TT before the company quickly reworked it. There was impending legislation in the 1970s that would have outlawed open tops, and this may have persuaded British Leyland that the Spitfire's days were numbered and production should end, but the lack of money at British Leyland at that time also meant there was never a chance a Spitfire would get an overhaul. There just weren't the sales to make it a viable option. In fact, BL had all but abandoned the Triumph name as their sales dwindled. The only car on offer after the Spitfire was the Triumph TR7 that itself wasn't doing very well and would quickly end production. They brought the name back one more time for the Triumph Acclaim, a rebadged Honda Ballard that actually sold pretty well, but BL figured they needed to focus on less brands and the Triumph name was axed. The brand's currently owned by BMW, who show no sign of using it, but there's a Triumph motorcycle company that's still going strong. British Leyland became Austin Rover, then just Rover, and they bought a cheap open top back as the MGF in the 1990s that was a bit of a success story, and we'll be talking about that in a future podcast. If you like this podcast, then please let people know and leave me a rating and review. If you want to see these podcasts as a video, then take a look at my YouTube channel. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.